It's Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On this week's show, we attend the official launch of the Edinburgh International Film Festival to find out what's in store at this year's gathering. Released this week after premiering at Edinburgh last year is Lindy Hamon's Kicks, tracing the obsession of two young Liverpool girls for their footballing hero. I meet its two rising stars, Nicola Burley and Kerry Hayes. Sam Brooks and I will be reviewing some of the week's other releases, including Casey Affleck in Michael Winterbottom's The Killer Inside Me, Videocracy, a documentary exploring Italian TV in the Berlusconi age, and André Téchiné's La Fille sur le Train, The Girl on the Train. Oh yes, it's fresher than Theo Walcott, it's Film Weekly. With the World Cup in South Africa just days away, it's a smart move to release a film exploring the growing obsession with football. Kicks is a first-time feature from British director Lindy Hamon, telling the story of two young football fans, Jasmine and Nicole, who share a particular fascination with a star player, and they set out together to capture his attentions. Beautifully shot by cinematographer Eduardo Grau, who went on to work with Tom Ford on A Single Man, the film is a stylish, tense exploration of adolescent female friendship. Without doubt, it's the central performances from rising stars Nicola Burley and Kerry Hayes as Jasmine and Nicole that gives this film a dramatic charge. So it was with some trepidation that I went to meet Nicola and Kerry to talk Kicks.
Maybe the way forward is to get one really young before all the other girls come sniffing round. How do you know? You don't know if he'll end up minted and famous or stay some ugly no-mark from the park.
Trouble with you is, Jasmine, instead of a heart, you've got a great big clump and cash register.
No way. Mine's one of them platinum credit card swipe thingies.
Nicola Burley, Kerry Hayes, welcome to Film Weekly. Congratulations on Kicks. You guys, I feel a bit bad because I'm sitting in a chair in front of you two, and that makes me think of the film. This is a dangerous position to be in.
Just a bit, all right. We've got no rope.
Phew, I'm all right. I did love the film. It's a very strong film about female friendship. What did you do as actresses to kind of get that friendship going, to get that chemistry going, Kerry?
To be honest with you, we auditioned together, and then straight away, like, we're hazing together, and then we're living together. So it's kind of like, ooh, this relationship's come out of nowhere. But we got on well from the start, so we didn't really need to force much out of it, to be honest.
You lived together when you were making the film?
Yeah, we did, yeah. We were literally living in each other's pockets the whole time, so couldn't, like, escape each other, do you know what I mean? So it was good, it worked for it, you know.
Was that because it's a low-budget film, or is that because that's what the director, Lindy Hamon, thought would be good to kind of get your relationships going, Nicola?
I think it was a bit of both initially. I mean, they said prior to that, do you want to have your own apartment or do you want to stay together? I was already put in one place and it had, like, a big spare bedroom, so Kerry came in.
Is this in Liverpool?
Yeah, it's in Liverpool.
But you're from Liverpool?
Yeah, I'm from Liverpool, but I was living in London at the time, so... And it was much better because, like you're saying, you know, we spent all of our spare time together and we got to... really get to know each other. So then when we come bouncing on set the next day, you know, we've already been chatting the night before, so it wasn't like, oh, hiya, you're right, good morning. No, saw you 2 minutes ago when you were brushing your teeth, you know, and all that stuff. So.
But being from Liverpool, did that help you making the film? I mean, because you were probably the guide, because, I mean, the director's not from Liverpool, and Nicola's not from Liverpool. So were they asking you where to film, where to go, what to do?
No, to be honest with you, they picked some pretty decent spots that I would never have even thought of. They opened my eyes to a few parts of Liverpool. Because, you know, growing up there, you know, you take so many things for granted, a lot of scenery and stuff you don't even think. And it was kind of, I thought it was a good thing that Lindy and Edu went from, Edu wasn't from England anyway, but that Lindy wasn't from the north. Because they took on this whole new view of Liverpool from Brand New Pair of Eyes, which a lot of the audience will do as well, because it won't just be Liverpoolians watching it. So I think that's good. And also they did us proud. They put some beauty into Liverpool, which was nice.
That's the cinematographer Edu Grau that you mentioned there, who after you did A Single Man for Tom Ford with Colin Firth and got him an Oscar nomination. He does give it a bit of magic, doesn't he? The Liverpool sky and the Liverpool skyline, especially the scene where you two are, like, lying down looking at the stars.
Yeah, definitely. I think that they create really arty shots, and both Edu and Linda complimented each other very much in that way.
Did you, when you were growing up in Liverpool, Kerry, was it as football obsessed as your two characters become. I mean, it seemed to me that this is the perfect place for this story, because, I mean, there, I don't know of a town that is more football obsessed, but I don't know if that actually does kind of permeate to you as when you were a kid growing up.
Yeah, no, it really does. I mean, all I can remember from my childhood is the smell of the hot dogs, and, you know, like, because my nan's house was in Everton and we lived in Anfield, so we'd see all the Reds, you know, taking up our car spaces and littering the streets every time there was a match. And then, you know, you get that and you just see waves and waves of red. And then another time you go to Everton and you'd see waves and waves of blue, and you just couldn't escape it, really. And, you know...
What were you?
Blue. It was mental, because if you were, you know, you're walking around the Everton area and you're wearing a red shirt, that's bold. And then exactly the same in Anfield, if you're wearing the Everton, you know, it is quite bold, it's still strong.
But it's also that mix that that this film has, is where you can actually go and find a footballer, an Everton or a Liverpool footballer, they'll be out and about, you'll know where to find them. Is that, that's the case?
Yeah, there's a lot of bars and clubs that are specific to that kind of crowd. And, you know, you're aware, especially in, you know, like local newspapers and stuff, that these footballers hang out there. And a lot of, I mean, you know, there are footballers in these teams that came from around the corner from where you live, you know what I mean? So you, in some way, you've got a connection to some of them. But yeah, there are definite places where you know that they will be at certain times.
Have you done this?
No. I've been to these places. I've saw, but, but no, I didn't get involved. No.
You never copped off for someone from...
No, that'd just be weird. No, I couldn't. No, because you don't know. These guys, they're just normal guys, do you know what I mean? And they've been rocketed up to fame because they're so good at what they do. But then you get all of these girls who are latching onto them, and you kind of feel sorry for them in a way because, okay, yeah, you know, it's not like they don't invite it, but at the same time, you know, they've got a lot of girls coming up to them, and, you know, you don't even know if they'll like you for who you are, but they know that you've got a status and you've got money, so...
It is the film's kind of, you know, central kind of conceit is that this sort of happened, but it's actually what brings the two of you girls together. It's a kind of shared love, because you two shouldn't be friends at all, really. It's a kind of love that crosses the tracks.
Yeah, definitely. I think that for very different reasons they're obsessed by celebrity and by football. I think genuinely Nicole's character just loves Lee, and it's a belonging in her life. It's something that's consistent, even though she's creating it. But then I think Jasmine's just a wag wannabe. She just loves everything materialistic, and that's kind of her aspiration, really.
Yeah, that's you.
Yeah, Jasmine, not me.
No, I don't mean that's you, Nicola Burnett. That's
your... Yeah, Jasmine. Yeah.
Girls, I really enjoyed the film. I've seen it twice now. I'm going to see it three times by the end of this run. So, I don't have a lot of time to do that, and so I'm delighted. There's something kind of very special about the film, I think. Congratulations on it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Hope you enjoy it for the third time.
I've now kidnapped Zan Brooks, the Guardian's critic at large, joining me to run through some of the week's releases. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be kidnapped.
Yeah, you see.
Shows that I'm wanted.
You are. We're going to tie you down, Zan, to some opinions as well. The Killer Inside Me, we're going to look at Michael Winterbottom's new film starring Casey Affleck. We're going to look at Videocracy as well, about Silvio Berlusconi. And we're going to look at the veteran French director André Téchiné, who's back with a film called Girl on a Train, or La Fille sur le Train. Let's start with Michael Winterbottom, though, because this is The Killer Inside Me. This is him doing a Jim Thompson noir novel and transposing it to the big screen, a place where Jim Thompson's had varying degrees of success as a transposition goes over the years. Let's have a listen to Joyce, played by Jessica Alba, telling Lou, played by young Casey Affleck, she'll never give him up.
You think you're too good for me.
Don't start that.
You do. I'll never give you up. Never. And if you think you're too good for me now, make it so you won't be.
Oh, baby, you got your bowels in an uproar all over nothing. I was just thinking about the money.
I can get money.
Are you?
He's crazy about me and he's dumb as hell.
I'm sorry? Who's crazy about you and dumb as hell?
Omar Conway.
So here we are. We've got the Dusty Windbowls of Oklahoma. We've got Ella Fitzgerald on the soundtrack. People called Slim and a voiceover. I should love all this noirish stuff.
But that suggests that you didn't love this at all.
I didn't.
Right. Okay.
Did you?
I liked it with some major, major reservations. That
How
I'm sure
major? The size of a Buick?
The size of a dust bowl town in West Texas, I think. And I'm sure the reservations that I have are the ones that are shared by you.
Well, let's see. What did you like about it?
I thought it was brilliantly made. I think it's, as you say, it's a very familiar terrain that Winterbottom is treading here. You know, most recently, I guess we saw it in No Country for Old Men, that sort of parched desert landscape, the sleepy town, the slight air of decay and corruption. I think it's brilliantly acted, largely brilliantly acted. I think that Casey Affleck is absolutely superb as the Deputy Sheriff Lou Ford,
yep.
Who's outwardly very courteous and deferential and the model law enforcement officer, but then, of course, has dark secrets. Kate Hudson is an actress that normally I would cross the road to avoid, but I think that she is absolutely amazing in this film as his fiancée.
Yeah.
Jessica Alba, less sure, and I think that Jessica Alba's performance maybe highlights a problem with the film as a whole.
Right. I didn't think the Casey Affleck was very good at all.
Okay.
I thought he was weak. I didn't get the kind of turmoil that was going on inside this guy. And I didn't like Kate Hudson in it either. I didn't think she was particularly woozy or sexy or moving or had any depth for her. And nor Jessica Alba as well, a woman who, of course, is a rather beautiful young lady. I thought she was totally wrong, badly cast,
yeah,
as the kind of
totally miscast.
If she was a prostitute, she would be a very unsuccessful one, I thought, in this town. Because no one would really go and fall in love with her. And I didn't get what was going on in this film. I didn't get the turmoil. I didn't like it either. After, well, I mean, apart from the fact that I didn't think it was very well made, I thought the cinematography, normally from the extremely reliable Marcel Ziskin,
yeah,
was kind of ugly and sort of empathetic with the tone of Jim Thompson's prose. And then we get the violence, which is at the heart of this film and the heart of the debate about the film.
Yes, this is the key thing about this film. I mean, basically, the Thompson book is a first person pulp noir,
literally pulp,
which is the narrator is, he's an unreliable narrator.
Yes.
This film is perhaps made by an unreliable narrator, in that I wasn't quite sure what Winterbottom's attitude was to this character. Basically, it has a lot of violence against women, sexualized violence against women, and it's about the masochism of women who like that kind of treatment.
Yes.
All of which is fine. All of which is an entirely valid subject for a film.
Absolutely.
But it's how you handle it that you live and die by. And Winterbottom, I wasn't sure how much he was inviting us to get off on this. There's a lot of camera shots around Jessica Alba's kind of pert arse. There's a lot of,
it's not just her pert arse, there's Kate Hudson's pert arse.
There's a lot of pert arses
in this. Lou Ford's mum in flashback, her pert arse as well, all getting nice wheels on them as, that's W-E-A-L-S, as they get whacked by hands and belts and all this.
Yeah.
Then there's the scene that everyone's talking about is the scene where Casey Affleck smashes Jessica Alba's face to a pulp. And we get this in close-up. I mean, I had to look away.
Again, as we say, it's valid, but and maybe it's part of the nature of film that it's the great hurdle of film that it romanticizes whatever it shows.
Yeah.
Whether that's a war crime, whether that's violence, just the way it's lit and shot and edited raises it up.
And carefully constructed.
And
these things don't happen by mistake. Yeah. That's the thing with the film. With a novel, you can do what you like because it's in your own head and you can sort of interpret the prose. But with the, I think that the prose by Jim Thompson is, it's her face till it caves in.
Yeah.
Well, it's a sickening read in the first place, but you can do what you like with it. This one, you're forced to see,
yeah,
Michael Winterbottom's interpretation of that. You can't make your own interpretation of it.
No.
And I would argue that that's a problem with this movie. I think he's misjudged
an
interpretation
has.
Of the material.
I think he has. And I think, as you said, I think that Ulber is miscast.
This film, I think he doesn't handle the characters right. And nor does he get the right performances out of them enough for me to kind of feel that these characters deserve the treatment they're getting.
I think you're right. And I think that in terms of its milieu and its sense of place and its sense of moral lives, it's a film that's actually probably more indebted to other movies.
Yeah.
Its sense of it is, the violence in it is like sort of dodgy films from like the 70s or something in its depiction of violence against women. It's like he's watched those and is doing this incredibly hyperreal pastiche of those films.
Yes, but he hasn't got like Tarantino pastiche.
No.
He hasn't got a kind of flippancy to it.
No,
he hasn't
no,
got
it's
a kind
not
of
it's not knowing. It's dogged.
I think so. Pause for thought there for Michael Winterbottom's The Killer Inside Me, which is out this week in the UK. Let's move to a documentary this time, Videocracy, which is a documentary by a Italian-born filmmaker, Eric Galdini, who then moved to Sweden and now makes this documentary about his and his young generation of Italians who've grown up on a diet of scantily clad women on Italian TV every Saturday night. Now these women then get embroiled in political scandals and some of them end up as ministers for their country.
Veline are TV showgirls. They're not allowed to speak. Their place is at the side of the host, standing in what is called the Velina position.
Zan, has Berlusconi's control of the media for the last 30 years poisoned the nation so?
I think it's probably poisoned Gandini's chances of ever coming back from Sweden. I think he's there for a little while yet. This is funny to see this after being in Cannes a couple of weeks ago and seeing Dracula,
exactly.
Which was Sabina Guzzanti's documentary on Berlusconi's handling of the Aquila earthquake from 2 years ago. This, again, tells us what we probably pretty much know anyway, that Berlusconi is the devil, that he controls pretty much every aspect of public and cultural life in Italy, right down to the TV channels, which, you know, serve as, I guess, the opiate of the masses with a diet of sort of semi-clad women bumping and grinding. And this, of course, is bad. But I wonder just how bad Gandini thinks it is.
Well, he sets it up to sort of say, has this sickened my nation? Have we become a nation of people who just want to be on TV because of the television of the president, where every day these kind of queues of hopefuls go to kind of audition in a rather kind of sordid way?
Yeah.
Is that worse TV than, you know, Manhattan Cable or kind of any local TV station around the world? Is it really the grip of Berlusconi that's making this, or is it just the opiate of TV itself?
I think he's arguing that it's the grip of Berlusconi, that this is a deliberate thing. I'm not sure whether it is, but that's certainly his
thesis. Isn't
his
it?
Thesis is that this is a sort of softcore neo-fascism.
There's also the stuff about the Weather Girls and the Billionaires Club in the Costa Smeralda in Italy, which is run by this kind of rather kind of...
There's some quite grotesque characters,
yeah, aren't
in
there?
Film.
Lele Mora, yes. Is the big TV agent.
A sort of aging playboy.
Him I loved. That was a great discovery. he looked like a Bond villain. He does this white house, La Casabianca, where everything is white. The sheets, the bedside tables, his shoes, his tie. You can almost can't see him. It's almost like he's done some Marcel Marceau figure. And he's the great puppet puller of all of this. And then the paparazzi who are in the control of Berlusconi, and the gossip rags that are in the control of Berlusconi. But I couldn't quite work out where the filmmaker was going with all this. I mean, I was like, yes, it's bad that the president kind of...
I don't think he's going anywhere.
He didn't really
have anywhere. That is the stumbling block of this film. I mean, you know, his thesis is television and power are one and the same. Having said that, where does he then go? And where he goes is basically this sort of lofty scorn of the intelligentsia for the great unwashed of Italy, the great mass of the Italian public who are kind of sleepwalking towards oblivion. But at the same time, there's a slight dodgy aspect to the amount of footage he's got from these TV shows throughout his film of the kind of the jiggling breasts and the and the grinding asses, that you're thinking, so you need to show us this in at great length, do you, so we really get the message.
And he found one bloke who was sort of wants to be on TV and he's trying to become a martial artist.
Yeah,
and
he's a mechanic who does karate on the side.
And to his mum's kind of enjoyment on the lawn. But he was hardly kind of a version of like the poisoned, kind of strangled nature of Italian youth.
Not at
was
all.
He?
Not at all. Maybe we're playing into Berlusconi's hands a little bit here, but the liberal, artistic middle class hate him. And I think with good cause, and by all means make documentaries about Berlusconi, but this wasn't as good as Dracula.
No. Funny enough, you never see these films at Venice, it strikes me.
No, they had Tornatore's film opening Venice, didn't they, that Berlusconi actually bankrolled.
Yes, rather nice, it is too. Everyone looks gorgeous and women have large breasts, but in their right place. That's Italy for you. Let's move to France, to Paris, to Girl on a Train, or La Fille sur le Train, a real-life story from 2004 in which a woman claimed to be the victim of an anti-Semitic attack on the air, or the kind of, that's the fast metro that goes in, like, from Charles de Gaulle into the centre of town. She claimed to have been the victim of an anti-Semitic attack, but in fact wasn't, and had made it up. André Téchiné takes this story and makes it into a sort of complex family drama that reflects the modern Parisian conundrums of living side by side with various races. Here is a scene where the police are informing the mother, played by the French great Catherine Deneuve, of the incident involving her daughter, Émilie Duquesne.
Bonjour madame, c'est la police. Madame. Jeanne Fabre habite bien ici?
Oui, je suis sa mère.
On peut la voir?
Elle n'est pas rentrée depuis hier matin. J'arrive pas à la joindre sur son portable.
Bah nous non plus, justement. Si vous la voyez, vous lui dites de m'appeler au commissariat d'Aubervilliers. Je vais vous laisser ma carte.
Mais pourquoi, il s'est passé quelque chose?
Elle a déposé plainte hier. Elle s'est fait agresser par...
Oui, just in case you didn't understand that, what was going on there.
Sounded great.
Sounded excellent. Catherine Deneuve, there's Michel Blanc in there. These French greats. André Téchiné, who's a kind of veteran French director. And Émilie Duquesne, who shot to fame as the Dardenne brothers' Rosetta all those years ago. This is Téchiné back... He does kind of pastoral drama sometimes, like Wild Reeds.
Yeah.
Here he is back in kind of the urban setting.
Yeah, like Le Voleurs. Did you ever see that?
Yes,
that
was great. I loved that one as well. And here he is with rollerblading people in parks in Paris on the modern in the modern era, and looking at it, like, I guess from the point of view of a 74-year-old man, which is, I rather like this.
I like this a lot. I like this a lot. It's divided handily into chapters, two chapters: circumstances and consequences.
Circonstances. Et conséquences. There you go.
You're giving me a little primer in a whole different language during this podcast. I call it cause and effect.
Yeah, yeah, that's what it is.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. Maybe I should do the subtitles for the English release. And so it is Émilie Duquesne as Jean who concocts this story. She draws swastikas on her body but gets them sort of the wrong way round because she's doing it in the mirror. Cuts her hair with scissors and comes up with this story of this anti-Semitic attack by Algerians that is revealed to be a tissue of lies, and it is based on a true story. It's an elliptical film, this. It's not, you know, the way we're talking about it makes it sound like it's a real state-of-the-nation morality.
Yes, you're right. It could be sort of a tough La Haine kind of document.
And it's really not.
No,
and
it's I guess a very bourgeois drama.
Téchiné doesn't really do that kind of tub-thumping at all. So it's a quiet film in a lot of ways. And the Duquesne character is remains slightly unknowable.
Yes, I like
throughout.
That about her.
Yeah.
Because it is a mystery of why the original person would have wanted to do this in the first place. There's a suggestion that she eyes this Jewish family from afar. One of them is played by Elsa Zilberstein, who is Mrs. Antoine de Cône, or used to be. I don't know if she still is.
Who knows the French?
But so there is this kind of Jewish sort of this other story set up, this kind of Jewish family, which does she want to be part of it?
Yes, it's sort of leading up to this bar mitzvah, which sort of is a parallel story that gains sort of precedence during the second half of the film. I suppose what Téchiné is making a film about is media culture and the sort of the culture of victimhood and the craving to belong to something, even if that means taking on the pain of that group that you wish to belong to. And so there's a slight sort of sense of rootlessness to this film, that these characters are sort of drifting and trying to find their place.
Well, literally, I think that the metaphor is that there's a lot of rolling going on. So the train rolls, the area, and then there's a lot of rollerblading going on in the park. And it's a kind of leisurely film, pace of which I like. I mean, it's not particularly long, it's not like it goes on for hours, but it feels that there's the gaps in between is kind of where the film sort of takes some light. That's where you get the time to think, what's going on here?
That is the sort of the style that Téchiné has, that he sets up which might be a high concept plot and then pulls away all the props and sees it if it still floats. And that, I think, can flummox some people who want the big moral lesson or the easy answer or the big confrontation. And instead, you're sort of just cast adrift in this dilemma and have to find your own way out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, someone else might have made a much, as you say, a much more kind of visceral film. Tony Scott, for example, might have made kind of a whiz-bang version of this film about this attack, which kind of went
around the world. The girl on the plane, that would have been.
Wow, get off my plane, you girl, with your anti-Semitic attack. That's the girl on the train. So, and we've got nice different ones there. They've got The Killer Inside, we've got Videocracy, and we got The Girl on the Train. Do you have a film of the week out of those three?
I think The Girl on the Train is the most perfectly realised of those films.
I agree with you. Je suis d'accord. Zan Brooks, thank you very much indeed for all of Zan's reviews and the best film news site in the world. Go to guardian.co.uk/film.
Thank you all for coming. I'm Hannah McGill, the Artistic Director of the Festival.
We are at the official launch of the 64th Edinburgh International Film Festival, and I'm joined by the event's Artistic Director, Hannah McGill. Welcome to your own launch, Hannah.
Thank you very much, Jason.
Film Weekly will be in Edinburgh as ever, but I wanted to get in there early because this is the lineup assembled in sparkling array. When you launch a festival, what is the aim of it? You want to kind of get people buying tickets, get those bums on seats early, but you've got a very loyal audience anyway, haven't you?
We do, but it's about building up the buzz. It's about getting the press on board and getting the people talking and getting the word out and about in Edinburgh and beyond Edinburgh and down here, just so that people know what's going on and the gossip begins and the speculation begins about who's going to be around. And so, yeah, it's building a bit of excitement and the tickets go on sale very soon.
I noticed there's another little tagline that you've got for the festival this year. What will you discover, it says, which I think is really perfect. Did you come up with that? Have you been in marketing meetings? Did you get Don from Mad Men to come up with that and pay him fortune?
I wish he had turned up, but no, my marketing department, who are very similar in style to Don from Mad Men, we wanted very much to emphasise the fact that we are a festival of discovery, that some of the titles that we've premiered over the 64 years of the festival have gone on to be real classics. So it was really about reminding people that discovery is the point. That and this year particularly, you know, we've got loads and loads of really new filmmakers. Over 80 of the feature films in the programme are by first or second time filmmakers. We've got 22 world premieres, so it is a lot of really new stuff. So the idea is you find your classic, you tell all your friends, and actually our audience can help those films to get out into a wider world by talking them up, writing about them on the internet. Those films can get distribution through that kind of buzz starting at Edinburgh. So.
Well, on the show this week we've got The Girls from Kix as well, the film I saw first at Edinburgh last year and is released now, which is really smart ahead of the World Cup. So that is the journey a film can go on from Edinburgh. You're the artistic director, so in a way it's kind of like, you know, picking favourite children. And I wouldn't really want you to kind of pick, but you must have some highlights of this festival that you can just pinpoint people towards. Your opening night film, Sylvain Chomet's The Illusionist, for starters. That's a godsend, isn't it?
It is a godsend. It is the most beautiful evocation of Scotland and particularly of Edinburgh, I think, ever on film. Perfect for us. Even features one of our venues, the Cameo, as part of the film. And also, we have an amazing new venue for our opening night this year, which is the Festival Theatre, which is an old music hall that is exactly where that magician would have performed if he had come to Edinburgh on his journey, as he does in the film. And so we're in a beautiful old theatre with this wonderful film that's a tribute to old school showbiz and to the beauty of Scotland. So yeah, the opening night's terrific. I really love The Runaways, which is a real rock and roll chick flick about Joan Jett and the Runaways, starring Kristen Stewart and Dakota Fanning. We've got some really great comedies, World's Greatest Dad with Robin Williams, which is unbelievably dark. And, you know, so dark that I couldn't quite believe it. And I was kind of like, am I allowed to show this? But that's really, really funny. A really funny kind of high school stoner movie in the tradition of John Hughes, which is called High School. But also some of the smaller British stuff is really amazing. The closing night is a really fabulous film by Hattie Dalton called Third Star, which I'm really excited about. And we've got some amazing documentaries. Some of the docs that were world premiering, there's one called Out of the Ashes, which is all about the Afghan cricket team and their efforts to get to the Cricket World Cup. And I know nothing about cricket, but I just fell in love with this film. It's so, so sweet. And a side of Afghanistan that nobody's thinking about. Ordinary, real people doing their thing.
There are things that you've discovered as well while you've been doing this job for the last year. People have been sending you stuff. You get a DVD that arrives sort of on the desk. Is that one of these surprises? You just put it in, you think, my God, this is brilliant. Has no one else seen this? I can't believe it.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, we have an open submission system where anyone can send a film to us and we get, you know, thousands of them, including the shorts. And, you know, you wade through a hell of a lot of stuff. We've watched thousands of films to put this program together. But occasionally, it's exactly as you say, something comes through, either just through submissions or through a producer getting in touch with us. And you watch it and you go, this is going to be ours. And you get so excited about putting it in front of an audience and meeting the filmmakers. So those are the really thrilling ones for us.
So that's from the little things. What about the big things? Some of the big stars that are going to be in attendance. We've got some of the usual suspects. Sir Sean Connery.
Yep, our patron Sir Sean Connery will be around, heading towards his 80th birthday this year, so we're having a special gala screening of The Man Who Would Be King to celebrate the wonder of Sean. Tilda Swinton, our other patron, is coming in as well. And in terms of the stars, I think we've worked out that 80% of the films are going to have talent with them. We don't always know exactly who's coming until the day, but there will be lots and lots of familiar faces from Hollywood, from the UK, and brand new people as well.
Hannah, you've been brilliant as ever here on Film Weekly. Will we be seeing you on stage? You got any talks lined up? Are we going to see Hannah McGill in action?
I will be in action non-stop. I will be running around in impractical heels, talking to everybody. And yes, there will be on-stage interviews. We've got our BAFTA interview is Sir Patrick Stewart, which I'm so excited about.
Are you doing that?
I don't actually know yet, but I think I might stop anyone else from doing that. But I might get a bit girly on stage, so I'm not. It's that voice. It's the voice, isn't it? We've got a Variety interview in association with Variety magazine with Graham King, who is Martin Scorsese's favourite producer at the moment and won the Oscar for The Departed. There'll be talks. Sylvain Chomet is going to do a talk about the making of The Illusionist. There's lots of exciting stuff going on in the talking front as well.
Well, get the heels nice, get some cushion in there. Don't want any corns, no blisters, no heel trouble. Hannah McGill, Artistic Director of the 64th Edinburgh International Film Festival. Best of luck with the festival and thanks for having us at your launch.
Thank you very much. See you on the 16th of June.
What is that? What is it?
Why is it?
Well, here at the launch of the 64th Edinburgh International Film Festival, I'd like to seek out a bit of talent that we're going to be spotting in a couple of weeks' time at Edinburgh itself, but there's a bit of milling around here. I've got a young director whose film Monsters is already creating a bit of buzz ahead of its screening in Edinburgh. Gareth Edwards, welcome to Film Weekly.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about your film Monsters. Why are there monsters? Are there monsters in it? There better be monsters.
You do see monsters, yes. Yeah, you do. It's basically, I've always wanted to make a monster movie, and essentially, I didn't want to repeat the kind of monster movies I've already seen. And so the idea is this is a monster movie that begins pretty much where most monster movies normally end. It's years down the line, and the way we sort of explain it to people is that, say, if your typical Godzilla or King Kong or whatever it is like a September 11th type event,
right. Then
this is more like the War on Terror, six years later when no one cares anymore, no one gives a crap, and it's happening the other side of the world, and it's not really affecting the Western world too much.
Right. So, and monster movies generally, the ones you mentioned, God, they require a big budget. They require kind of CGI. Presumably, as a sort of first-time British filmmaker, this enormous budget was not available to you. How did you get around that?
Well, my background, in a sense, is visual effects. I actually always wanted to make films, and when I was at film school, my flatmate happened to be studying this new thing called computer animation, and it just opened my eyes to this new tool, which I thought at the time was going to be as powerful as like cameras and editing. Yeah. And so I just decided to kind of embrace it and get my head around it, buy a computer and learn how to do this thing. And it took me a lot longer than I wanted it to, but eventually I learned the skills where you can essentially create anything in your mind on screen. And I think home computers are kind of there now, so you don't need any money really.
It's funny, isn't it? Because monster features, creature features, they've been big budget, they've also been low budget. If you go back to the original Godzillas, obviously they're kind of Japanese movies, they're kind of lo-fi, if you like.
I think there's an extra realism that comes from that sort of lo-fi approach, but our goal when we set out was to make the world's most realistic monster movie, is kind of what we told ourselves.
Do we actually see some monsters? I want monsters, Gareth.
You do. In the first... Someone asked me this the other day. You see them within the first 16 seconds of the film, and I would go down.
Are they scary? Are they like, eh? Are they like dinosaurs? Are they like hairy? What sort of monsters?
I have a theory about where they're from, and they're kind of like, I don't want to give it away, to be honest
no,
with you,
that's
but
true.
You definitely see them, and you definitely...
You've got to design monsters.
I would go up against Jaws, Alien, Cloverfield in terms of on-screen airtime that is given to the monsters. The thing is that because it's such a character piece, everyone, and you do start to care about these two people we're following, that they steal the show. And so it the perception is that there isn't that many monsters, but they are there.
Brilliant. Now, you're the first-time British filmmaker up at Edinburgh Film Festival. It's a brilliant platform for first-time British filmmakers. Discoveries, you're going to be one of those at Edinburgh, which is very exciting. But is it difficult in Britain to get something like this made? I can imagine the UK Film Council going, nah, we don't do monsters. We want gritty social realism. How did you get your film made?
I basically met Vertigo Films, who have got like balls the size of England, to give us the money to make this, and it has all kind of worked out. But yeah, no, they, I mean, basically, for me, I was going to just fund it myself. I was trying to come up with an idea where I could pick up a camera, go somewhere, and create something quite commercial, but also that I would, you know, want to put my name to as a first film. And once you do that and you get a commercial idea that's very cheap, then a lot of people give you money to go and make it.
Roger Corman started out that way. Maybe this is the new Roger Corman we're discovering here. We're going to find out for sure if that's the case at the Edinburgh International Film Festival. Gareth Edwards, good luck with your film Monsters.
Thanks for having me.
To find out more about this year's Edinburgh International Film Festival lineup and how to get tickets, just go to their website, edfilmfest.org.uk. And that is it for this week. The music featured on the show has been from Kix, featuring Liverpool's finest, Ladytron, amongst others. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for the Trailer Trash column, of course, and the best film news and reviews. We leave you with the voice of one of the great screen actors and figures of contemporary cinema, who sadly passed away this week, and we couldn't leave without marking that. So a clip from Apocalypse Now, one of the many profoundly brilliant performances by the late Dennis Hopper, who died last week.
Those were crossed with the red dot.
This is dialectics. It's very simple dialectics. 1 through 9. No maybes, no supposes, no fractions. You can't travel in space. You can't go out into space, you know, without, like, you know, with fractions. What are you going to land on? 1/4, 3/8? What are you going to do when you go from here to Venus or something? That's dialectic physics, okay? Dialectic logic is there's only love and hate. You either love somebody or you hate them. This is the way the fucking world ends. Look at this fucking shit we're in, man. Not with a bang, whimper, and with a whimper, I'm fucking splitting, Jack.